Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Change Your Diet, Change the World show. Our salute to Jeff Goldblum and his apartment finding advertisements. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. Rick Phillips, my usual co-medical host, is on assignment in Salt Lake. And with us to take his place from the St. Clair Regional Medical Center, the manager of Clinical Nutrition Services, registered dietitian. Her initials include MSRD, LD, CDE, Jean Jones. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Tony.
And also with us from the University of Kentucky, dietetic intern Jordan Bressler. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, Tony.
Our website to listen to the show is WMKY.org. Go take a listen to past shows and see how we have declined through the years. You can download that as an MP3 file. We also are on iTunes as a podcast. You can also go to our Facebook page, HM Radio Show, and look at our research. Leave comments there, as many of our listeners have been doing recently. We enjoy the conversation, even though we don't always agree with the comments, but we can't have everything. Our sponsor for today's show, the Tick Fixers, with their top six quick tick fixing tricks. That's right, it is tick season, ladies and gentlemen. Ticks cannot compete when you use DEET. That is our motto. First of all, I want to tell you, well, and Gene, the reason I did this, as we mentioned before the show, I was out working along the driveway this weekend, and I was attacked by a Lone Star tick. I know it was a Lone Star tick. One, I identified it when I pulled it off. But two, these things are vicious, aggressive biters. They basically, rather than just walking to a place and biting in, these ticks will they will bite all along the way. Yeah, so the frustrating thing, Gene, was I saw these bites going up my leg, and I said, okay, I know I've got a Lone Star tick, but I couldn't find it. Well, the next morning I found it, but by that time, I have violent reactions now, skin reactions to ticks. So I got this big red spot and a tick, and I pulled it off, and it's a Lone Star tick. These things are just the nastiest thing. Over in August, about, they have their larva and their nymph stages. And the larva, I always thought larva was a worm. Did you, when you think of larva?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Lone Star tick, their larva are just little bitty ticks.
What color are they?
They are black. They are dots. They look like just like dots. And there's this dot on your leg, and it is itching like nobody's business. And if you get a magnifying glass, they'll have 6 to 8 legs, and they look like real tiny magnifying glass ticks.
My husband one time came home from hiking, and he was covered in these little black dots.
You can have dozens. You can have hundreds of them if you blunder into a nest, mm-hmm. and we'll call that word blunder, and they bite in. And this is later on in the summer. Not really a springtime problem, but it will get worse later on. They nest in loose leaves, and these things are an absolute mess. I have also done that and never want to do it again. The local people call them turkey mites. You may have heard that term, especially over in the western part of the state of Kentucky. But in fact, they are the larva form of this Lone Star tick. Well, here's, rather than our top six quick tick fixing tricks, which we'll have our next fractional portion, here's the thing not to do when you pick off a tick. First, don't use sharp forceps. It turns out sharp forceps actually puncture the tick and cause more trouble than they help. This number two, don't crush, puncture, or squeeze the tick's body, because basically at that point the tick is like a hypodermic syringe, and you are injecting yourself with whatever is in the tick. Its fluids may have infectious organisms. Nothing like squeezing the tick and pushing those into your body. The other thing here, number three, don't apply things like petroleum jelly, gasoline, nail polish, or other noxious substances to the tick. This prolongs your exposure time. You're sitting there with the tick, and the tick's under some Vaseline or something, but the tick is still there. Ticks breathe 3 to 15 breaths per hour. 3 breaths per hour. So try suffocating something that breathes 3 breaths per hour. And keep in mind, they're attached to your bloodstream. So there's really, if they need oxygen, they have a source. It's not necessarily the air around them. You cannot suffocate a tick.
So how do you remove them?
Well, that'll be our second fraction. Don't get ahead of us, Gene. Don't get ahead of us. Don't apply heat with a match or a hot nail. Animal studies have shown that irritating the tick does not stimulate the tick to detach. This tick is bit in. This tick will remain bit in. You cannot distract a tick. You cannot tell tick jokes. You can't annoy it. You can't tickle the tick. None of those things works. The tick will remain bit in. Don't use a twisting or jerking motion. Remove the tick. Parts break off and things go bad. And don't handle the tick with your bare hands. Now, I have a problem. I'm very good up until the last one. See, Our mission is to kill the tick and to punish the tick for biting us.
Amen.
Yeah. And so we have to handle the tick in order to get it in the proper position to squeeze the life out of it.
Oh, no. I prefer a heavy hammer.
You use a hammer, but you have to do something with the tick. When you pick the tick off, you should just...
I'm guilty of the sharp forceps.
Yeah. So you have that, and then you go with a hammer.
Yeah.
And bam.
Or drop him into a cup full of alcohol and watch him squirm.
Really? You are one.
I hate ticks.
I got that. You're very emotional about this stuff. Well, we handle it. As a matter of fact, I pulled one off, and I was going to move this tick over to where I could torture it, and I dropped it in our bathroom rug, which is we have a plush rug.
See?
And, but here's the sort of good news is the next morning I was in the bathroom barefooted, and he comes back up on my foot, or at least I think it was him. I didn't really.
Seconds.
Yeah. And so I was able to take care of this tick because he got greedy and came back. But at any rate, those are the things not to do. We'll have our top six quick tick fixing tricks in the second fractional portion. That's our sponsor, the Tick Fixer's top six quick tick fixing tricks. Remind you, ticks can't compete when you use DEET. Now, this part, Jordan is looking at me with this panic look because I know she is worried about being a radio celebrity personality. It turns out she's not sure yet that she is one, and so she's trying to figure out what to do. But I did want to talk a little bit, Jordan, about how you became a dietetic intern, how you got interested in clinical nutrition and so forth. My first question, though, may surprise you, and that is, can you swim?
I can swim very well.
Okay. So, all right. So that's, what are we, Gene? Now, we've had two good swimmers, and I think we've had three non-swimmers, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So the thing is, and we've talked about this before. Gene, remind us of the Berea story, if you don't mind.
Do you want me to tell it? Really?
I do.
Well, I'm a graduate of Berea College, and when I was in school a long, long time ago, when you first came to Berea, you had to take this battery of tests, and one of the things that you had to take a test on, you had to pass a swimming test because they thought that everyone should be able to swim. Well, I couldn't swim, and I told them right up front they didn't need to test me. I sank like a rock, and now you have to do the test. Well, I did the test, and I sank like a rock, and so I had to take this one semester swim class. And I couldn't graduate without passing it. And they couldn't teach me to swim. And I'm not afraid of water. I would get in the pool and I would have a great time, but I couldn't swim a lick. And so finally, the last day of class comes up, and Miss Chrisman says, "Look here, you're going to have to pass this swim test. You have to jump off the diving board. I don't care how you do it, and you've got to swim from the deep end to the shallow end and back again. I don't care how you do it, but you've got to, or you have to repeat this class until you can." I was like, "Okay, well." I held my nose and I jumped into the deep end of that pool off that diving board and I dog paddled from one end to the other and back again.
So
and
you can
somewhere,
imagine.
Somewhere in the middle of it, you know, I'm like, you know, surface enough to get some kind of a breath, and I realized that everybody's lined up on both sides of the pool going, "Go, go, go!" You know,
cue the Rocky theme. Jean, in fact, is drowning her way from one end of the pool to the other. This is one of the great moments. I really wish I'd been there. This should be a made for TV movie, and it's so exciting. But the thing that underlines it, in my opinion, is that many dietitians have a very lean body, lean muscle mass, and not so much fat. And dietitians sink as a rule. My son is a sinker. He learned to swim with a life vest on, but he to this day, if he goes snorkeling, has to wear a flotation belt, or he will in fact snorkel to the bottom of the ocean. So I'm just testing out a little theory here to find out.
Should try again because I think now I probably would be okay.
You might be a floater now. You never know. But it is terrifying to learn to swim when you sink to the bottom. It's very easy. I was always, I'm a floater. You know, I can swim or not swim. I can, either way, I'm fine.
Well, add to the terror the fact that I'm shorter than 5 foot.
The bottom is a much farther distance than Jean.
And the shallow end is over my head.
That's right. Okay. There is no shallow end of the pool when you're Jean's height.
Unless you're in the kiddie pool.
All right, so I'm sorry. We got distracted. But at any rate, so you can swim. But talk to us a little bit about why you became a dietary. dietitian?
So I'm not quite a dietitian yet. I will be once I graduate and take my test. But I guess it all started, I don't know exactly when it started, but I've always had this fascination with reading nutrition facts labels. My mom said, like, since like middle school, I just read them for like fun because I thought they were really interesting. So then when I was in high school, I thought I was going to be a vet. So I always had this like interest in agriculture, mostly animals at that point. So I thought I was going to be a vet. And then I realized I don't want to be a vet because I rode horses. And I was like, hey, you need to have more to life than just horses. You have to do something else. So then I have family in the medical field and I really like science. So I thought, oh, hey, I'll be physical therapist and occupational therapist. Then I realized, you know, I don't really like that either. So then I was kind of at this point where I had no idea what I wanted to do. And I was a senior in high school and I had taken ag science classes all 4 years and I really, really loved it. And I really like started getting really interested in food production and how it got to someone's mouth, the consumer's mouth. And then I had never heard of like a dietitian until then. And I really liked the idea of tying in the science part that I really enjoyed with food, which came about with nutrition. And I came to UK and actually had no idea what I wanted to do. I was undecided and it happened that they had a really good dietetic program. And I finally switched that for my first semester and then I ended up really, really enjoying it.
Well, euphemistically call this progressive targeting. You can see how she narrowed her focus and so forth with all those I didn't know what to do. Let me ask you, did you cook a lot during high school?
I actually didn't. My mom cooked a lot. She always is cooking and baking and she would be in the kitchen and I would immediately leave and I'd go outside and my brother would go in and help in the kitchen. So it was really odd when all of a sudden I had this fascination with food and now I cook all the time.
Okay. Yeah, and I can understand certainly with that. But Jean, I know you came at it from an entirely different. We talked a lot about home economics in high school and the importance of being able to cook. But you really, Jordan, were more into food production from an agricultural standpoint. That's really where you started rather than from actually food consumption and cooking, which I think is pretty interesting. I guess you can get to it either way, but I know your interests within the dietary field, within the field of clinical nutrition, are a little bit different than many dietitians in the sense of you're looking more on the production side.
I see a trend, though. I think more and more dietetic students are going at it from that angle. I think there's a big interest in that now, and I really like that. I wish that had been true when I was at that point.
You know, we'll certainly hope to explore that a little bit more in our second fractional portion, but did it turn out, we've got just a few more seconds left in this fractional portion to talk. Did it turn out like you expected then when you started down this path and you started in clinical nutrition, you now cook more? Was this so far a satisfying career? You think you're heading in the right direction?
Very, very much. And I got a lot of opportunities while I was an undergrad to get involved with kind of the food security side, which helped just like solidify that this is what I want to do.
So everything from farm-grown produce all the way to personal nutrition coaching to healthcare, a lot of possibilities within the field of clinical nutrition in general. Speaking of possibilities, we've possibly run through most of this fractional portion. We're rapidly running out of time. We'll talk more about our tick fixers, tick tricks, and we'll also talk some about dietary guidelines and other issues in our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of our program. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio. This is the Change Your Diet, Change the World show. Our liberal use of Jeff Goldblum's apartment hunting theme. with us to talk about changing your diet and changing the world from St. Clair Regional Medical Center, Manager of Clinical Nutrition Services, Registered Dietitian to the Stars, Jean Jones. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Tony.
And also, University of Kentucky Dietetic Intern, Jordan Bressler. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, Tony.
Our sponsor for the second time, the Tick Fixers, the top 6 quick tick fixing tricks, reminding you ticks can't compete when you use DEET. And here are the 6 tricks. First of all, trick number 1, avoiding ticks is key to avoiding tick-borne diseases. Wear long pants. Tuck your pant legs into your socks to ward off the immature ticks on the ground. Do you do that? Do you tuck your... I just cannot do it.
No,
I mean, it just...
I use short socks when I work in the garden. I like DEET.
Yeah.
the better.
Yeah. If skin exposure, this is what they say. First of all, inspect your skin, especially the armpit and groin areas. That's the diaper area, immediately after outdoor activities to check for these things. But in many cases, they bite in elsewhere. So you really got to look at your skin pretty completely after you come in from the outside, especially if you have been in high grass or in loose leaves, which is where ticks like to live. If skin exposure is unavoidable, apply an insect repellent. The most effective is DEET. Products with 10 to 35% DEET are adequate in most circumstances. 10% lasts around 2 hours. 35% will give you about 24% gives you about 5 hours of protection. 35% then is going to give you about 7 or 8 hours of protection. Again, if you swim, if you perspire heavily, it will wash off. It can cause hives or a blister reaction if you're allergic to it, so watch out for that. Products with more than 30% DEET should not be used on children. Permethrin, that's Permanone, kills ticks and mites. It can be applied to your clothes. It'll last through several washings and is handy. Trick number two, ticks are best removed as soon as possible. The risk of disease transmission increases significantly after 24 hours. If you can get to them early, you can avoid most of those nasty diseases they transmit. Trick number three, the use of blunt, medium-tipped forceps offers the best results. Don't twist or jerk. And after you remove the tick, check the bite area for any retained mouth parts of the tick because you don't want to leave anything in. Trick number four, once the tick is removed, wash the bite area with soap and water. I tend not to do that. I tend to forget that. I'm too busy torturing the tick. You know, because if you use the soap and water, then you got to put the tick down. And I'm not finished with that tick yet.
Can you not use rubbing alcohol? Is that not okay?
You could do that. Yeah.
See, you get a cup of alcohol, you dip your cotton ball in there, you rub your affected area, and then you dump the tick in the alcohol. Works great.
I'm going to try that out. I haven't done that. Trick number five, routine antibiotics are not indicated. You may consider that in pregnant patients or in areas where there are high rates of tick-borne diseases, but here in Kentucky, we do not use routine antibiotics just simply because you are bitten by a tick. This weekend, I was bitten by a tick. I removed the tick. I have no plans to use any antibiotics. And trick number six, the size and color of the tick helps determine what kind it is. If it is black, size of a pencil point, that's the deer tick. These are in the mid-Atlantic region mainly, but they could be in Kentucky, although mostly mid-Atlantic and also Minnesota, Wisconsin area, and Northern California. Brown with a white collar, that's the dog tick that we've had around here for years. Brown to black with a white splotch on the back is that Lone Star tick. And as I mentioned, the nests of those are the turkey mites, the larva, the really tiny ticks. Those are the turkey mites. And then the adult mite is a vicious spider. It will bite several times before selecting a place to settle in. So you can identify by looking at the tick what type of tick bit you. That is our top six quick tick fixing tricks. Avoid the bites. Remove as soon as possible, preferably within 24 hours. Use blunt forceps, not sharp tweezers, because they macerate the body and they may then transmit diseases. Wash the area afterward. Routine antibiotics not necessary, and take time to identify the tick because it may, in fact, affect the type of disease you have. Our sponsor, the Tick Fixers, with the top six quick tick fixing tricks. Ticks can compete when you use DEET. Now, this first article, these are not earth-shaking articles, but this one came out of Melbourne, Australia, was talking about confectionery consumption and overweight and obesity. And these guys at University of Melbourne, the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, Royal Children's Hospital, they looked at all the articles on candy and obesity. And they found 19 studies, 177,000 people, and they looked to see if chocolate or other confectionaries, eating those was associated with a higher risk of obesity, because they figured you eat candy, you get fat. It turns out the odds of being overweight or obese were 18% lower for people in the highest category of confectionery consumption. One time per week increase in consumption was associated with a 13% decrease in the odds of being overweight or obese. Now, I did not know this, but for me personally, I do not, my weight problems have really never been related to how much candy I eat.
I'm not a candy eater. I mean, I'm rather fond of those little peanut butter things with the chocolate coating on them.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not like I go out and buy one. If somebody, like, offers me one, I'll take one. You know, the little mini ones, you know?
Yeah. That's my problem, I think. As we've talked about, I am cookies are my nemesis. If you had a big plate of Oreos, I would finish it. Mm-hmm. I would finish it as fast as I possibly could. I could barely.
Oreos are good.
Yeah. And there's a tremendous amount of calories. On the other hand, those things you're talking about, you have to unwrap each one, which slows me down. have to. Now, if I had an assistant to unwrap the candy, then I might get into trouble with the candy. But right now, I have to do it all myself, and it's just not worthwhile.
Huh.
So now you've got to be careful about chocolate research. This was an analysis, and they had no funding from any chocolate people. But Mars Candy Company right now is spending a lot of money to research the benefits of chocolate. So when you see dark chocolate helping blood pressure and other things, this is not necessarily scientists following the trail of inquiry.
They're wanting to sell you something.
Yeah, they get paid for that. So I'm not saying that chocolate is bad, just saying that chocolate has a little bit of an edge because there's a lot of funded research right now on chocolate. So you see more about chocolate than you would say about peanut butter or other things, even though they have their own funding. Jordan, how about the candy? Were you a candy lover as a child or recently?
Well, I didn't like sweets at all when I was younger. And then now I really love sweets, but it's not necessarily candy. It's more like ice cream.
I have
a major obsession with ice cream.
I like ice cream, but I try not to keep it around, but I do like it.
You know, and I don't know. I guess it's, once again, you have to have a utensil to eat ice cream, which...
God, he likes to eat with his hands.
I do. You know, I've got the point now where eating the ice cream, you know, it hurts my teeth.
Really?
When you get something really cold. And so I could not put, say, a handful of ice cream in my mouth. There would be repercussions.
Well, how big a bite are you going to put in there?
Well, if the cookies are any example, pretty much as much as I can get in. But in fact, if I limit myself to a spoonful, ice cream is actually not a temptation. So cakes, pies, ice cream, not a problem. Candy, because you have to unwrap it. Now, if they make candy sandwiches...
You're a lazy eater, aren't you?
You might be right. So what kind of ice cream, Jordan? I'm interested in this.
Everything. My goal is to try every flavor of Blizzard on the Dairy Queen menu. I never get the same one. I like different ones every time. And I also have chunks in it. I like chunks of things.
But see, I don't like those. I like premium ice cream.
I like the candy in my ice cream.
Now, you're probably too young to remember when we put stuff in Jell-O. They would have Jell-O, and then you would put fruit in the Jell-O.
It's not... my mom makes that, but it's not creamy enough for me.
I understand. So you don't like fruit? Do you like just Jell-O without the fruit?
I like Jell-O with fruit. I just would prefer
ice cream with she's candy. Pretty much anything chunks is okay. You're a...
Hate Jell-O. Hate Jell-O.
Just in general, hate Jell-O any way.
Yes.
And so putting fruit in Jell-O doesn't help at all.
No.
Okay. Just want to make sure we're on the same page. But I'm not really surprised. I think that, and it's odd, but I think you worry about dental problems with candy, certainly.
Yeah.
But apparently...
I fail to believe that the people who eat a lot of candy don't have weight problems. I'm sorry.
Well, they mentioned there's something called reverse causality. It may be that people, when they start to get really overweight, they start cutting back on candy because it's something they can cut out. So we may be looking at it backwards. It may be that obese people don't eat candy rather than people who eat candy are not obese. But at any rate, it doesn't seem... And I would say my own personal experience, the problems I have certainly nothing to do with
eating too much candy. You have to be really careful about, like, totally restricting your children from things like that. You know, my mother liked candy. And there was always candy at the house, you know, and I was allowed to buy it. You know, and I always went for the sour things, you know, like those big sour cherry suckers, you know, they used to have. I don't remember what they were called. But it was always there. And, you know, honestly, it would probably end up getting old and having to be thrown away because I think I liked walking to the store and buying it better than I liked eating it, you know. So I just, nobody told me I couldn't have it, and I didn't really care that much about it.
I cannot talk about candy without talking about Jolly Ranchers. I hate Jolly Ranchers.
I love Jolly Ranchers.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we got that out of the way because they stick to your teeth.
It depends on your technique.
Oh. You
have to keep it on your tongue.
Yeah, I was going to say, nestle it in your tongue, protect it from your teeth. Yeah. Mine gets stuck to the teeth, and at that point, I'm busy with trying to pick the Jolly Rancher off my teeth, and there's no fun at all. Jordan, Jolly Ranchers?
I agree with you that I just get stuck to my teeth.
Yeah, so, Gene, you're on your own with Jolly Ranchers. I'm sorry, confectioners always remind me. I am in a minority, apparently, with Jolly Ranchers. Jordan, you and I are in a minority on that. My son loves gummy bears. I don't understand.
Gummy bears are
like Jell-O. You know. Basically. Okay, so we're all united against gummy bears. just want to make sure that we get that out of the way. I will never, ever, ever get fat off gummy bears and Jolly Ranchers. Though that is not, among all my nightmares, that's not one that keeps me up at night, I promise.
It's Oreos. Piles and piles of Oreos.
You can eat a pack of Oreos in one sitting. You know that.
No.
Very easy.
Yeah, exactly. No. I mean, you can put them in a blizzard. You put them in ice cream. Oreos can pretty much go anywhere. it is scary exactly what you can do with Oreos. I'm just saying. And boy, you talk about calories. I tell you what, you know, you take a pile of Oreos and you take a pile of whatever you want. If you want Reese's peanut butter cups, or if you want M&Ms or whatever, I'll be through those. I can get more calories in my mouth than you can if I have the Oreos.
No doubt.
Yeah. So.
Because I'm only going to eat two of those Reese's cups, the little ones.
Well, by the time you get it unwrapped, I've already finished the Oreos. Just pointing that out. Now, this is a part of the program, and we got to do this, Gene. This is called Gene's Rants. Gene was talking about the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, and Gene has some issues with that. And I thought, as a takeoff point for that, Ezekiel Emanuel, who is Rahm Emanuel's brother and was one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act, he published an article in the American Medical Association, their internal medicine journal, and the points on this are really weak. They just are. And so I wanted to highlight his points, and then we're just going to let Gene basically melt one of the mics here in the studio talking about it. And Gene, you said you have a solution.
I have a solution. I do.
To our healthcare problem. So here's what we got. All right. So these are his key points in his article. I've got 7 key points in the article and then a conclusion. So here we go with key points 1 through 7, and then I'll turn the mic over to Gene and I'll get out of the way and put on my helmet. Number one, the rate of uninsurance has declined from 18% to 12%. Number two, if all the states had expanded Medicaid, 21 million residents would have insurance with 25 million uninsured. Number three, the Affordable Care Act helped keep health care inflation modest. We have low health care cost growth in part due to the Affordable Care Act. Number four, it was less expensive than predicted. Coverage provisions have decreased 29%, but of course this includes the fact that many states didn't expand Medicaid. Five, no has not inhibited employment expansion. We're expanding the economy even as we speak, and it has not been a drag on that. Six, has supported innovation. Total medical investment reached a new peak of $16 billion in 2015. And seven, created a framework for necessary payment change to transform the focus of healthcare to keeping people healthy. Conclusions. One, even though it's not a perfect bill, it has improved healthcare. Two, and this is an interesting conclusion. This was his closing conclusion. If venture capital investing is a trustworthy indicator, and if additional reforms are implemented, Americans can be optimistic about the future of the healthcare system. And I myself find that fascinating, that venture investment would be the indicator of the healthcare system.
Well, because, you know, as long as insurance companies rule it, all we're interested in is the bottom line. We don't care how much people suffer, as long as we're making money.
All right, Gene. Well, several things. I mean, again, he points out if the states had expanded Medicaid, 21 million residents would have insurance, but they didn't. It was not constitutional to force the states to expand Medicaid. Some did, some didn't. And so, yes, and if we all won the lottery, we would all be rich, but ifs don't really get things done.
Now, I'm not saying that Obamacare is entirely bad, okay, because certainly there are some good things that have come out of it. All right. But every time that I go to like a town hall thing or hear anything on the news or the radio or whatever about it, you hear all these, you know, media people and politicians saying, now we have like so many million people with insurance cards in their pocket. And that seems to always be the way they phrase it. Now they've got an insurance card. And, you know, I'm sorry, folks, but just because you have an insurance card in your pocket doesn't mean that you have access to good health care. That's just the bottom line. You know, just because I have an insurance policy doesn't mean that it's going to give me anything. They're going to deny as much as they possibly can, and they're going to make it as difficult for the healthcare providers to provide you with good healthcare. You know, the longer they keep you on the phone trying to get a pre-cert, the more likely you are to hang up and give up.
Yeah. This is one of the ways you slow down healthcare inflation, is you create hoops and obstacles for people to jump through who are providing healthcare.
And you know, there's a statement that he makes here in this article about how, you know, part of the reason that the cost hasn't inflated is due in part to, quote, the expansion of high deductible health plans that discourage use of health care services.
So we have insurance, but we do not have actual health care because we're discouraging it.
Yeah, I mean, and I've experienced this myself. I don't have a really bad health insurance policy, you know. I mean, last year, there were tests that I needed to have that I didn't have because when I looked at how much I was going to have to pay my part of that payment, I couldn't afford it. And I have a solution. I have a solution to this problem.
And here is Gene's solution to our healthcare problem.
I think that every one of our government representatives that have anything to do with healthcare reform and policies and laws, from the top all the way to the the bottom need to exist on about, $40,000 to $50,000 annual income every year with a $500 a month insurance premium for one person, you know, each person in the family, okay? And I want them to try to make that work. I want them to try to get the health care that they need with that mediocre health care policy that, the rest of us usually have to deal with, okay? And try to make those deductibles and those co-pays on that $50,000 to $60,000 income.
It's a good point. I work at a free clinic. We were overflowing. Kentucky expanded their Medicaid, and we basically, these clinics emptied out. They are, however, refilling now with people who simply can't afford the deductible part of their health insurance.
They got a card, but they can't use it.
Yeah, and so we see them at the free clinic. I would, it troubles me, I think, that he talks about health care inflation, and really, when you look at what people are spending out of pocket, though, to provide their health care, I don't think that that has been relatively modest. I think a lot of people have seen their costs go way up.
Oh, I think they have too.
What we've seen in Eastern Kentucky is almost a miracle with the expansion of Medicaid. It has made a huge difference in a lot of people that otherwise couldn't afford health care in their lives.
And that's very good.
Yeah.
If they get good health care. Of course, anything is better than nothing that they had before, right? So
right.
That is an improvement.
And then the other thing we've seen is people with chronic illnesses now. And I've had several people that can retire now because they're not hanging on for their corporate healthcare benefits.
Yes. And I like it that you know, you don't have to worry about pre-existing conditions. That's one of the best things about it.
So we've got those advantages, but it is discouraging to hear one of the healthcare system's architects talk about venture capital investment, talk about innovation, and talk about overall expenses being low because the states didn't enact Medicaid as was initially predicted. None of these things provides more health to more people.
No. I mean, we're not really making healthier people. We're not making illness go away. We're not making suffering go away. We're just making the bottom line look better. And by the way, the insurance companies are laughing all the way to the bank, you know.
Some are. United Health, though, looks like they're getting out of the exchanges because providing health care to those people who are sicker than thought has been a difficulty for them. So winners and losers, still a little bit hard to pick. I think it's going to take longer than we anticipated. Speaking of longer than anticipated, we have run over once again. You've been listening to our second fractional portion of Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio. Stay tuned.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio. I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Change Your Diet, Change the World show because we are swamped with dietitians in the studio today. First of all, from St. Clair Regional Medical Center, Manager of Clinical Nutrition Services, Registered Dietitian of the Stars, Jean Jones. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Tony.
And from the University of Kentucky, Dietetic Intern Jordan Bressler. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, Tony.
Our sponsor for the final time, the Tick Fixers and their top six quick tick fixing tricks, reminding you ticks can't compete when you use DEET. Those six tick fixing tricks are: number one, avoiding tick bites is the key. Tuck those pants into your socks. We know you look like an idiot, but you'll be very happy the next day. Inspect your skin, especially the armpit and groin areas, immediately after outdoor activities. If skin exposure is unavoidable, use DEET. 10 to 35% DEET. 10% lasts around 2 hours. 24% 5 hours. 35% around 8 hours. If you swim or if you perspire heavily, less than that. Products with more than 30% DEET should not be used on children. Also, remember permethrin, some of it is permanone. It is something you can treat your clothes with, will last several washings, and will repel ticks as well. Trick number two, they're best removed as soon as possible. The risk of disease increases significantly after 24 hours of attachment. It is really hard to transmit diseases until around 36 hours. So if you can get to the ticks quickly, you don't have to worry so much about disease transmission. Three, blunt angled forceps, best results. Sharp tweezers, not so good. Following tick removal, removal, the bite area should be inspected carefully for any retained mouth parts. You want to get this area clear. 4, use soap and water or with an antiseptic to destroy any contaminating microorganisms. And again, we mentioned alcohol, but mechanically wash the area off, push those germs away. 5, routine antibiotics not necessary. 6, remember your key to the tick identification. If it is dark brown or black, the size of a pencil point, that's a deer tick. If it is tiny, 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 like a dot, that's the larva form of the Lone Star tick. A brown to black tick with a white spot on its back is an adult Lone Star tick. Very aggressive biters. The larva form are the so-called turkey mites that swarm over your ankles if you step into a pile of loose leaves in July, August, and September, and they give you, for the next 2 weeks, just a unending misery. And then brown with a white collar, that's the old dog tick. Nothing to sneeze at. Dog ticks can certainly transmit Rocky Mountain spotted fever and other diseases, but those are the ones we are more familiar with. So that's our sponsor, our Tick Fixers Top 6 Quick Tick Fixing Tricks. Ticks cannot compete when you use DEET. Now, this is for Jordan because, again, we talked about the reason she became interested in clinical nutrition was more on the supply side. This was an article from Michael Pollan, and this was back in October 2008 as President Obama was taking office, and he was talking about basically a letter about the nation's food system. I'm going to make, he had 5 points here I want to make, and then 3 suggestions, and I'll just run through them quickly. First of all, he said, you will not be able to make significant progress on the healthcare crisis, energy independence, or climate change unless you address our food system. He seems to be prophetic in that regard. 2, after cars, the food system uses more fossil fuel than any other sector of the economy. That's 19%. Again, we're talking about pesticides, chemical fertilizers, farm machinery, modern food transportation, and food processing. All these things are energy intensive. We're spending way, way too much fossil fuel on our what should be actually pretty much a fuel-free process. 3, 4 of the top 10 killers in America are chronic diseases linked to diet, heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, and cancer. No coincidence that the years of national spending on health care went from 5% to 16% of the GDP, while the spending on food has fallen by a comparable amount from 18% to 10% of household income. You can't expect to reform the healthcare system without confronting the public health catastrophe that is the modern American diet. Public health catastrophe, Gene. Too much? Or you think that's right?
It's close.
I can see it. You know, we have, well, again, we actually talked about it last time. We've made food very convenient, very easy to take huge amounts, and relatively nutrition-free.
Nutrition-free, that's the problem.
Yeah, and we've labeled that junk food, and which is kind of, it still says it's food. And in fact, it's really, in terms of nutrition, not at all food. You can go to many restaurants in our fair city of Moorhead and order a meal and not get any food at all.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of nutrition. 4, national security. When a nation loses the ability to substantially feed itself, it is at the mercy of global commodity markets and also at the mercy of other governments, and we are importing our food. And then 5, he points out, the current food system, monocultures of corn and soy in the field, cheap calories of fat, sugar, and feedlot meat on the table, is not the product of a free market, but it is a set of government policies. And he points out, after World War II, the government encouraged the conversion of munitions industry to fertilizer with ammonium nitrate. We know that's, you make bombs out of that. You also make fertilizer. And that's how we got our fertilizer that we use on our field. Since we can feed our animals so cheaply with this fertilized stuff, America's meat and dairy animals migrated from farm to feedlot. Again, it's cheaper to do it that way, but it creates pollution problems and also creates problems with the fertilizer.
And the animals, let's not forget them.
Yeah. And then cheap energy, again, for the trucking industry, means that we get our food from either across the country or from other countries rather than next door or in a garden in our own front yard. He says, if we're going to solve this, says, 1, we should allow farmers to grow crops, healthy, fresh food. Right now, if a farmer gets a government subsidy, they are prohibited from doing that. Secondly, he points out, since 40% of the world's grain output is fed to animals, 11% is fed to cars, maybe we should start raising food to feed people rather than those things. We need to preserve every acre of farmland, and we need local and regional food. We need to support farmers markets. And finally, we should start in our schools teaching our children to raise and use gardens. So, Jordan, well, tell me what you think. We're headed down the wrong path in terms of food production and food processing?
Maybe slightly, but I think it also kind of goes back market consumers is what I always think about too. Like, there are government policies, but those policies in my mind came about for some reason. So to support, that was about the time when technology increased, there's more goods that people can purchase because they want to. And iPods didn't come about then, but that type of thing. And things that they don't necessarily need. So not food, not water, not clothing. So people wanted cheaper food to buy these other wants. So of course, to support the cheaper food, you have to support farmers, give them a way to produce that cheaper food. And then people want cheap, easy food. And then they want to be able to go to the grocery store and purchase any type of food they want. So that brings in the fossil fuels. So yes, we do transport food from all over the place. But that's because people want to see that blueberry in the Kroger in the middle of winter. That is obviously not going to be grown in Kentucky in your backyard in the winter. So that is a piece to the puzzle.
I see. So you're thinking we can't go back. We've gotten used to seeing these things from all over the world appear in our grocery stores. We've also gotten used to spending the money on something else, and we can't undo that.
I think it can be undone, but I don't think just looking at government policy is going to change that. You also have to look at consumers and changing their mind. Consumer has to be willing to pay a little more for good food. And I am very aware of the fact that a lot of people can't purchase food. They don't have the means to currently, but there are people who can, and I think those people need to be willing to spend a little more money. I think that people need to be willing to eat less. We, as a country, consume excess calories.
Obviously.
And the world already produces enough food to feed each person multiple times over. So it's not about increasing production. We already produce more than enough food. 40% of food that's produced is wasted. So there's food there for people. They need to be willing to spend a little more. They need to be a little more conscious of their purchases and not necessarily needing that blueberry in the middle of the winter. And if they do buy it frozen, there's other opportunities for having a food that was produced close in season in the middle of the winter, aka frozen.
I like blueberries on my oatmeal every morning.
So okay. you go wintertime, you'll go blueberries, you'll pay. I mean, they get pretty expensive in the winter, right?
Oh yeah. But I'll go frozen. That's okay.
Yeah. Okay. I think what about the garden part, Jordan? I mean, he says he even mentions the idea that the Obama should have plowed up part of the White House lawn. Again, this is Eleanor Roosevelt did a victory garden and started a trend. If we see active gardening going on in the White House and in our schools, then it'll become a part of our culture to have vegetable gardens.
I love that. You know, yeah. I do.
I think that's a wonderful idea because kids need to be, we're in this time where kids don't know about the production of food. No longer does their grandfather farm. It's less common, still common, but less common. No longer do they live on farms themselves. So any type of getting to learn about agriculture in a garden in their school is going to be helpful. But kids don't understand where that food's coming from. So they're out there buying all this processed stuff. They want cheap food because they don't see the labor that goes into it. They don't see everything that goes into production of food. So they're not as conscious about their purchases.
You know, I talked to somebody about the farmer's market in Moorhead, and they said that it's pretty much the same people buying the food there pretty much all the time. And they noted that actually the people that frequent the farmer's market are oftentimes upper income people within our small town. And so we're still missing, I think the farmer's market should be one of the cheapest ways to get fresh produce.
And yet it's not. You know, sometimes it's not the cheapest way to get it. And I don't mind paying a little bit extra to get really fresh produce. So that's okay with me. But there are people who maybe can't afford that. Now, I think that I think we were talking about it earlier. I think that they can, in some places, get vouchers, can they not?
And SNAP, a lot of times, has double dollars.
Yeah, double dollars.
So you get double the amount you would to spend there, as well as WIC does the same thing in certain areas.
So there are ways. And one of the problems is where we are, the farmer's market, as you go farther south, the farmer's market becomes more of a year-round thing. And certainly they start bringing produce in earlier in the year. But here, there are some things built against the farmer's market. On the other hand, if we had adequate storage, we might be able to create a year-round farmer's market even as far north as Moorhead, Kentucky. Kentucky.
Yeah.
So once again, policies to support farmers bringing produce in and growing produce, getting used to, I know, Gene, you talked about cooking in the schools, but also raising food in the schools.
I love that. I mean, part of the problem is that people don't know how to cook fresh food either. Pardon me. They're used to getting something they just pop in the microwave, you know, or heat up out of a box. And I think that if you're going to eat better and more healthily, you've got to learn to cook a little bit. You don't have to be, you know, a gourmet chef. I've said this before. It doesn't be fancy food to be really good food.
I like the idea, though. I think that it really hits you when you start thinking about how much of the vegetables of our country are being fed to livestock, and generally in feedlot situations. And Wendell Berry actually said this best. You had a really nice thing where the animals eat the grain and fertilize the soil for more grain, and now we've broken that problem, that solution up into two problems. Now we have to add the ammonium nitrate fertilizer, and then we have to get rid of the animal waste, where it worked just fine when we had cows grazing on a pasture. It all took care of itself.
Exactly.
It's a little frustrating where we are. And Paula mentions this is going to be difficult. We want the freedom, realizing that government policies, again, we put our chemical weapons people developing insecticides, we put our bomb people developing ammonium nitrate fertilizers, we made it so that our farmers raised this huge amounts of grain, but they were not allowed to raise other vegetables if they got government subsidies. We created this thing with our government policies. You're right. Then an industry grew up around it, and that industry has done very well at selling food of no nutritional value to us. So now we've got all these things set in place. If we change our policies, and if we put a tax on fast food, if we put a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages and things like that, we could change our policies and maybe counteract some of the policies that we put in place. But those changes are going to arouse a lot of opposition because people still think this was a free market that created the situation we got now. Well, there it is. I thought it worth revisiting. This was, again, 8 years ago, and I will say I do not believe the Obamas, they're more urban people. I don't really think, I think would be a nice way to say it. I don't expect any, in the months we have left in the Obama administration, a great improvement in farm policy or in food policy, frankly, coming from this administration. A little bit disappointing, but I guess not entirely unexpected.
I do appreciate all those big farmers out there, though, that can feed all of us. Because let me tell you, we have learned doing our home gardening and fruit trees and everything that it's really hard to do that if you're not doing it full time, because you go to work and those squirrels will strip that plum tree bare.
Yeah, I feel the same way. The past just seems like they're going 24/7,
yeah,
and I can't afford to do that. I do. You would call it organic orchard simply because I don't have time to spray it with anything.
Yeah, I know.
So we do have we fight with the birds and the hornets and the worms and everything else for our apples in the fall when they get ripe. So it is a problem. Recognizing this, I think though I'd like to see some more support for the fresh vegetables. My wife is laughing right now because she knows we've had this argument about how many vegetables I would eat, frankly, if they were widely supported. I think there are better vegetables than the ones that I'm aware of. and I'm not going to try kale. I am not going to try kale. Not going to try kale. Don't care. Do you like kale?
I love kale. And actually, I worked on the university's vegetable farm this summer on the organic unit. And I got to taste kohlrabi. And it's my favorite vegetable now. It's spelled K-O-H-L-R-A-B-I. But it's like this odd, like almost turnip potato type flavor. And I highly suggest trying that if you find it.
Well, and how do you fix it?
You can eat it raw. You can substitute it for potatoes and like make shredded fried potatoes or fried kohlrabi or bake it like French fries and eat it with hummus.
If you fry it, I might be. I'd give it a shot.
Not fry, but like
saute.
Yeah, more like saute.
Now you're just making up words, Gene.
I like vegetables.
I know you do.
I don't like eggplant. I just can't
Thank
go
you.
There. I've tried it every way I can think, and I just every now and then we'll buy one and try to fix it again, and we just can't make it work. But pretty much everything else, you know. Mushrooms, but that's really not a vegetable, is it? It's a fungus.
And when we get to the fungus point, I think it's time for us to leave the air now and leave our dietitian. Special thanks to Gene Jones, Manager of Clinical Nutrition Services at St. Clair Regional Medical Center, UK dietary intern Jordan Bressler, Morehead State Public Radio producer Hunter Reese, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our toe-tapping Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org. Visit us on Facebook at HM Radio Show. For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember, Health Matters is a proton pump inhibitor radio show designed to reduce levels of stomach acid in patients with heartburn. Health Matters and other proton pump inhibitors like Prilosec and Nexium are generally safe and effective when used in accordance with a label which says you should not use them for longer than 14 days. However, long-term listening to Health Matters and other proton pump inhibitors has been linked to kidney disease, dementia, osteoporosis, risk of fractures, higher risk of gastric and esophageal cancer, and dangerous interactions with other drugs. Safety is important to us at Health Matters, and we believe our radio show is generally safe and effective for 14 days. We encourage you to work with your healthcare provider to determine the most appropriate way to listen to our show, and why not just ignore all that cancer and dementia stuff? Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week on Morehead State Public Radio as we continue our tribute to U.S. ophthalmologists. Remember, in times of crisis, your hometown ophthalmologist lends a hand. Oh, I'm sorry, that should be hands a lens.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.